Crime, Wine, and Chaos contains adult language and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Where we're going, we don't need roads, chaos kids. I'm Amber.
And I'm Naomi. And this is Crime, Wine, and Chaos.
It sure is.
I'm pretty sure I've used that one before.
God damn. You know what? You know what?
Do you want to start over?
Nope.
No, I'm fucked up.
No, I don't. Because it's true. It's still true. Maybe it's still true. You don't know.
It's Listen, always true. It's always true.
I am not going to. Now we need, in addition to the spreadsheet of stories we've done, we need a spreadsheet of intros we've done. This is getting
I'm happy to. You know what? I'm happy to do that work, sister.
Happy to do that work for you. It's going to turn into this complicated if-then reference spreadsheet. No. Let's keep it simple.
I'm happy to do it.
You do that. Hi.
I've got like a Dennis the Menace thing going on today. Look at this. Okay. Anyway.
That's really alfalfa sprout.
I'm having a bit of a week, but I'm going to make it through. I am doing this campaign, this letter writing campaign. I'm sending letters to the president, both our state senators, and my house rep every day, every single day for the month of December, demanding that they intervene on the humanitarian crisis that they all have, you know, supported and sending money to on the other side of the world. Anyway, that's where I'm at. How are you, sister?
Good. I'm proud of you for that. Let me know how I can be of service in that realm. Are you sending the same letter? You want to pass it on to me and I'll send it. We can double down.
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy to send it to you. You can tweak it and make it your own. That would be lovely. I'm trying to get this hashtag trending, hashtag be a swarm. Like we need to swarm, you know, we've talked about swarms, right? We've talked about when anything swarms, we talk about mobs like on here, right? Cause we've had quite a few chaos stories that turned into like actual mobs doing crazy things and you just got to kind of get out of the way or get trampled, like be a swarm. They can't control us if we all stand up together and make demands. So it's that's true. The thing. And of course there's boycotting we can do, they really want us to, boycott Starbucks, boycott McDonald's, boycott, Disney Plus. And then there's BDS, which is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions group that's existed for a really long time. And they have things on their boycott, very targeted boycotts for us for supporting the people in Palestine who are being wiped from this planet. So anyway, there's lots of things we can do that don't take a lot of work. They just take a little bit of extra knowledge and we can be supportive. Did you know, Amber, that Bethlehem has canceled Christmas this year?
Oh, I heard that. Yes. Yeah.
So Christmas is kind of taken a back seat for a lot of people this year because doesn't seem right. So,
yeah, I get that.
What else is going on with you?
Oh, gosh. Well, a hard pivot. Have we talked to the Chaos Kids since we did the Found Footage Festival?
We have not. I don't think we have.
I fully nerded out meeting those guys. That was like anyone who will listen, or even if they don't want to, I make them and I'm showing everyone the picture. Look at what I did. Incredible.
You guys, she maybe was the cutest.
You could see
it was
Frisbee
so adorable.
Fuckers behind me on my music stand a little bit in the shot.
I can't see it in the video from my view, but yeah, Amber, it was adorable. You guys, Amber was so cute. She was just like a kid in a candy store. We went and talked to them at the merch table. I bought her Frisbee. We got our picture taken with those guys. She was so happy. It was so cute.
If you
follow us on the socials, then you've seen the pictures. I posted pictures about it.
Oh my God. Shit eating grin. Like, yeah. Thank you for that. Oh man.
You're so welcome, sister.
What a gem that footage festival is. God.
I love making dreams come true, you know? I'll be your fairy godmother.
Thank you. Thank you for asking. I'm drinking a 2019 Trevente Reserve from Malbec. It's a deep red. It's also
deep red.
Uh-huh. I made a pot roast tonight, and that was part of the... It was in the crock pot all day with my roast. It was so good.
That sounds amazing.
It was. Thank you.
I think tonight's going to be probably a popcorn dinner for me, but it's, you know, pot roast sounds amazing.
You know, good for you. Do you want me to run over some leftovers? I will. No. Okay.
Sister, should I tell you a crime? I'm going to tell you a please. Crime. So I'm going to set this one up a little bit because, as you know, I actually went in and picked one and then decided on a different one, but this is from the list. So we have a longtime loyal listener, good friend of mine, friend of the pod, friend of Erica, April, mm-hmm. who sent us an email like a week or two ago with a whole list of stories she recommended we should cover. And she's like, you know, deep into it. So I went looking into that list and I initially picked one. And then I was like, oh, that doesn't seem, I want to get deeper into that. I don't know if I have the time to get as deep into that as I want to get into. So I went looking for another one. So I just kind of randomly picked another one off the list. And I started to dig into it. And so there's a Forensic Files episode about this case. Mm-hmm. And within the first like 3 minutes of watching this episode, Amber, I realized I have a personal connection to this woman.
Oh.
So I'm going to tell you the story of Carolyn Roberts. That's her maiden name.
Okay.
Okay. So in 1998, Carolyn was 36 years old and living what looked like the ideal life. She was born and raised in the Seattle area, and she was married to Robert Durrell, who was 41 at the time. They had three beautiful children and lived in Renton Hills, just south of Bellevue, Washington. Bob, as his friends and family called him, was an IT guy at the King County Housing Authority, and he made a pretty good living. So in the early years of their marriage, Carolyn took off from working so she could raise their kids. But eventually she went back to work. And when she went back to work, she ended up working at Morgan Stanley Dean Witter in Bellevue.
Oh, you used to work there.
I used to work there. It was a stock brokerage firm, and she made a good living for herself because she was quite smart. I worked there in 1999.
And what year is she there?
These events take place in 1998.
Wow. I have so many follow-up questions. Maybe it's too soon.
We'll get into it. But so anyway, Carolyn is also described by her friends as selfless and warm. She always did things for other people, and she cared deeply about others. She was also punctual and reliable. So when she failed to arrive at work on the morning of August 7th, 1998, her office called her house. Whoever called spoke with Robert, Bob, who told them that Carolyn had left for work that morning at her usual time. As far as he knew, nothing was amiss.
Okay. So it's a pretty short drive, I would imagine.
Yeah, Renton to Bellevue. Not that far.
Mm-mm.
So her friends called the police, or Bob did. I found both of these. I found it said both ways in different articles. You know how that goes down. And so I'm not really sure which is true. A couple of the articles said that Bob called and reported her missing. And supposedly he said that she may have run away with a man she met online.
That's what Bob said?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Bob's not looking good.
No. Either way, the Renton police head out to Bob and Carolyn's house, and they knock on the door and they get no response. The door is unlocked, however, so they do just let themselves in.
Okay. That's
so they do a walkthrough and they find nothing out of the ordinary.
Oh, right. Because the previous night when they were there for dinner, that's how the house looked then too.
Right. Because they know what ordinary looks like Carolyn and Bob's house. Right. So all Carolyn's things are there at the house, like her stuff, generally speaking. Her car is not. So for 2 days, there's no sign of Carolyn. And then police get a call about a red minivan driving erratically, and the license plate belongs to Carolyn's car. According to the witness, the van was weaving in and out of traffic, slowing down, speeding up, and the witness couldn't get past the van or, you know, to get a look at the driver or anything.
Is that what she drove, or are you saying that somebody took her plates?
No, this is what she drove. She drove a red minivan. So friends put up missing person flyers around the community, and a convenience store clerk called in to say that he had seen Carolyn in his store the day after she disappeared, and he was sure it was her who came in to get gas, purchasing it with cash. Bob looked around the house for clues, and he found information on her computer that he turned over to the police. And this is when police find evidence that Carolyn had been having an affair. There were emails and chat room conversations with a man named Kevin Johnson that indicated they had been having some kind of relationship that was pretty serious. They had real conversations about running away together.
Oh, shit. All right. Maybe I take it back, Bob. Sorry.
So police pull Kevin in for an interview, and he admits that, yes, he and Carolyn had had an affair briefly, but they had not seen each other for about 6 months. So Carolyn's bestie, Denise, was adamant that Carolyn didn't run off and abandon her kids, and that she certainly wouldn't disappear without calling Denise or her mom, Carolyn's mom, like Carolyn would have called her mom. So Denise, I worked with Denise.
Oh, you did?
Yes. And this is where it's so weird, because as soon as I started reading the story, I remember these like very brief conversations about Carolyn, and like, we didn't talk about it. And Denise was very upset, and it was something we didn't talk about. But like, it was clear. All I knew was that like, there used to be a woman who worked there named Carolyn, who Denise was super fucking tight with, and she wasn't there anymore, and something bad had happened, and like, we don't talk about it.
Weird.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, poor Denise.
I know. And Denise was like this super like bubbly, like happy, like really nice. I mean, she was such a nice woman, and she was just a joy to work with. And I was like, I was a baby. I was like, this was 1999. So I was, how like old?
19?
Like 20, 19, 20. 20? Yeah, I was like, I was like 20 years old. So this was like 25 years ago that I worked there. I was like 20 years old. I worked there for like maybe a year. And she was always just so, so sweet. And you know what I mean? Like, anyway, I had chills. I got like goosebumps. The police go digging further into Kevin. They interview him multiple times, and they find out that Kevin's alibi fully checks out. So about a week after Carolyn went missing, her van was discovered parked at a hotel next to SeaTac Airport. But there were no records indicating she had stayed at that hotel or had boarded any flights. So
sorry, Kevin, she met online, but he sounds like he's a local person, though.
Yes.
Okay.
Match. I'm not sure if it was on Match. So there was a forensic examination of Carolyn's van, but nothing of note was discovered. There were no fingerprints that they wouldn't expect to find there. Additionally, a look into Carolyn's bank accounts showed that it had not been touched since she disappeared. In fact, she had just deposited a bonus into her account that she'd received the week she went missing, and it was all in there. So none of the evidence at this point gave police any indication that Carolyn had run off somewhere on her own accord.
Right.
Carolyn's work friends tell the police that the day before she disappeared, she said to some of them that if anything happens to her, her life is in her desk.
You know, God, that's so fucking smart.
And
you
how many times have we heard a woman say this to her friends? Something along these lines.
I didn't think that my life was in danger, but I did something similar back when I worked at the school district, just on a piece of paper, make, model, vehicle number, name, date of birth, and handed it to my coworker.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah.
So police search through her things at work. They find books about divorce. Her friend Denise said that Carolyn had also been saving up some money and consulted with a couple of divorce lawyers. And police also found in Carolyn's desk a draft of a very long letter that she had written to Bob, trying to explain to him why she needed to leave him. She talked about Bob being too controlling and obsessive and jealous, and she talked about being unbearably unhappy.
Oh.
Carolyn told her friends that Bob was abusive. Not physically, but she said she was uncomfortable around him. He emotionally controlled her with his obsessive behavior, and she didn't ever feel good around him. He monitored where she went. Sometimes he would just show up when she would be out with her friends, like at lunch or whatever.
Oh, God.
He was basically stalking his own wife.
Right, right. We've talked about this before too, where that like sort of, I don't want to call it like an in-between, but this gray area where it's like, my energy just feels bad around you and you don't yep. necessarily have like a thing that you can hang your hat on and say, okay, that, you know what I mean?
Right.
And even right. behaviors like that can be misconstrued for like, he really cares about your safety or, you know what I'm saying? Like you can trick yourself into
yes.
thinking that those things are okay and not abusive.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Although ladies, we're all learning, actually everyone, we're all learning that there's mm-hmm. lots of different ways to be abused, right?
Mm-hmm.
So police interviewed Bob, of course, and he admitted that their marriage had issues, but he said it was ridiculous to suggest that he may be involved in her disappearance. When asked about the night before Carolyn disappeared, Bob said that the two went out to dinner together at a nearby restaurant. And when they got home, Carolyn had a phone call with her sister-in-law, Bob's sister. According to Bob's sister, Carolyn sounded a bit tipsy on their call, and Carolyn told her something like, oh yeah, Bob made me a drink, which Bob's sister found quite odd because it was always the other way around. Carolyn would wait on Bob. Bob did not wait on Carolyn. Bob did not bring Carolyn food or make her a drink, like ever.
Well, good for the sister, too, for just being very truthful, even though, you know, that's her brother.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So now the police take a gander on over to Bob's place of employment to search his computer there because, see, he worked for the county. So they could just seize that shit since his work computer was government property.
Mm-hmm.
They gave that computer to Gordon Mitchell, an expert in computer forensics, and he got into the hard drive on that bad boy, and he found evidence that Bob had deleted files that were still sitting on the hard drive, because you know nothing is ever really deleted. Actually, I learned a little something that I didn't really know before, even though I've spent my whole life like working tangentially or like working in tech. Apparently, when you hit delete, the hard drive doesn't actually delete it. What it does is it marks that file as like space that can be used.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's still there. And eventually, if you need space, it will overwrite that information with new information once it gets to the point where it needs it. But basically, it's still sitting there. It's just like marked as deleted, but it's not actually gone.
So where is there? Well, first off, that sounds just like CCTV. Like it's there until it's time to reset the clock and then it's gone. Where are these things existing in the deleted, not deleted space?
On the hard drive.
Asking for a friend.
on the hard drive. They're on the hard drive. They're imprinted on the hard drive.
Also, I just had a weird, sidebars today. I just had another weird connection moment about you knowing Denise. So Erica, who used to be the co-host of this podcast, her dad worked for King County Housing Authority for years and years and years. And I'm positive he was working there in
1998
or whatever. I mean, he retired from there. He was
that's
there
crazy.
Forever.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. Well, I mean, that's what happens when you do local stories that go back, you know, because with the locals when you're all local.
Yeah.
It turns out Bob was also having affairs, multiple, with women he had been meeting on Match.com. His profile on Match, of course, claimed that he was living separately from his wife and that he was fully available for a relationship. And in the emails he exchanged with women he connected to on that site, he claimed that divorce was impossible because it would be too expensive and messy. He even said that he would be better off if his wife were dead.
Oh my God. That's not how you get a second date, dude. What the fuck? God.
Can you imagine?
No, I can't imagine.
If somebody said that to me while I was chatting with them on a dating app, like, what?
I would be looking up his wife and like, sister, are you okay?
Hello? Yeah. Hello, police?
Yeah, fuck.
Oh my God.
No.
And then his internet searches. Because you know how these guys and their internet searches always go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those revealed that he was looking for any and all manners of murder methods, from poisoning to physical assault. And he even had one search that was simply kill spouse.
Oh, my God. He couldn't even bother using a proper sentence. Jesus Christ. The 90s too, right? When you thought that the interweb was just like this magical place that where you were completely anonymous.
Yeah, but this guy's in IT. His degree is in computer sciences. He has a job in computers. He runs the IT department. He didn't know that this stuff was discoverable. Did he think that the police wouldn't be able to access someone to do that forensic work for them? Like, what?
What an idiot.
I mean, exactly. I literally wrote, idiot.
Idiot.
What? Mm-hmm. Even one of the dudes on the show said this right after I wrote it. Like, I was writing this and then like Forensic Files kept going. And like one of the, I don't know, prosecutors or whatever was like, I'm baffled that this guy didn't think that, like, he worked in IT. How could he not know that this was discoverable information?
I don't know.
Government issued computer that they had legal access to without even getting a warrant.
Of course. That's day one of any government job. Like, only put it in an email if you're okay with it being printed in the paper.
Right.
Yeah.
Seriously. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fuck. So this was enough evidence to point to probable cause and secure a search warrant for the Durrells' home. And they made a beeline for the main bedroom, obviously. You guys, we don't say master bedroom anymore. Just side note. They found a spot on the carpet that looked like it had been cleaned. They swabbed it with phenolphthalein and that turned purple, which indicates blood. Mm-hmm. Also, they found two squares of carpet under the bed that had been cut out and replaced. Underneath those, there was evidence of large pools of blood that had been cleaned with water and some kind of cleaning solution. And then everywhere around the bed, on the headboard, the walls, the nightstands, everywhere, tiny blood spatters, massive amounts of blood spatters. They were also able to determine that the blood lower on the walls, closer to the floor, was caused by coughing.
Oh, no.
Someone very low to the ground coughing up blood.
That's awful.
According to the experts, higher up on the walls and on the ceiling was medium velocity spatter consistent with someone swinging a bloody object. Mm-hmm. There was also a bloodstain on a doorway leading to the garage, and in his car, they found a receipt for a specialty cleaning product. They also collected DNA from the blood and compared it to DNA from Carolyn's parents, and this was conclusively Carolyn's blood.
Yeah.
Police were certain they knew what had happened to Carolyn at this point, but what they didn't know yet was where was her body. But they had enough evidence and they saw enough, like, of the blood pooling to know that she did not survive. So Bob was charged and arrested on October 26, not even 3 weeks after Carolyn was reported missing, for her murder, which he denied.
Of course.
Of course. But while sitting there waiting for trial, someone supposedly overheard him praying to be forgiven for what he'd done.
This guy is so fucking dumb. Waiting for trial, like in the courtroom?
No, like in jail.
Oh, in jail. Okay.
Right. Well, so like grain of salt, right? Grain of salt though, right? Those ones are always grain of salt. So even though prosecutors decided they had plenty of evidence that Carolyn was dead, even without her body, of course they wanted to find her. So they took a deal to Bob's attorneys and they said if he led them to the location of her body, they would not use that fact as evidence in trial. Like, tell us where she is and we won't tell the jury that you took us to her.
Okay, right? That's an interesting deal instead of a sentencing deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Bob took this deal and he led the police up into the Cascade Mountains about an hour's drive away, not far off I-90 in North Bend, where at the base of a very steep ravine, they found Carolyn's body in a plastic bag under a pile of rocks.
Oh.
An autopsy showed that Carolyn died of blunt force trauma, just as investigators had concluded based on the forensic evidence. And while toxicology tests were inconclusive, prosecutors were pretty sure Bob had drugged Carolyn with something in that drink he made her that night after they returned from dinner. And once she made her way to bed, he beat her repeatedly on the head, wrapped her in plastic, carried her to the garage, and dumped her in the ravine and went home to clean up. The kids were all staying the night in other places that night, so he had all the time and solitude that he would need to carry this all out unseen.
You know, they both were having affairs. It sounds like they both would have been benefited and whatever from just having a divorce. Like, what the fuck are we doing?
Well, yeah. They also concluded that it was Bob driving the minivan like a crazy person that day on his way to ditch it at that hotel by the airport. Prosecutors also figured that that convenience store clerk must have just been mistaken when he thought he'd seen Carolyn the day after she went missing. They pulled the tape from the store and they saw no evidence of Carolyn having been in the store that day.
Okay.
And it was clear Bob didn't want to lose any of his money in a divorce. He didn't want to pay child support or lose half the house. And Carolyn came for money. Bob also didn't want to lose access to any possible inheritance that might come to him as Carolyn's widower.
The fuck? Wow.
Bob pled not guilty. His trial began in June of 2000, almost 2 years after Carolyn's murder. Bob's story was wild. He said that two men, this is our favorite. This one comes up. This is always the story that they make up so many times. This is the story they make up. Two men killed Carolyn and forced him to dispose of her body. And then they threatened to kill him and his children if he went to the police, Amber.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure like that scenario has never actually happened.
No, it's never actually happened.
No. Like one of these days, this is going to work.
We heard some dude on the stand make this fucking story up. This story. Mm-hmm. It's always this story.
Yeah.
Two dudes came in and made it happen. Mm-hmm. They made me. Yeah. They made me do it. They made me cover her up.
Yeah. They were in ski masks. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, God. On October 7th of 2000, exactly 2 years to the day that Carolyn failed to show up to work and so worried her coworkers and friends, the jury deliberated for a mere 2 hours and came back with a guilty verdict for first degree murder. Bob was sentenced to 45 years and 8 months in prison. Judge Deborah Fleck, while reading his sentence, called the case, quote, aggravated domestic violence preceded by a pattern of psychological abuse.
Good for her.
She also said that the pictures of Carolyn's so badly beaten body were some of the most horrific she had ever seen.
Mm.
Bob's attorney had, of course, requested that Bob be sentenced within the standard range of 20 to 26 years, but the senior prosecuting attorney argued that the internet research into ways to kill his wife showed premeditation that deserved an exceptional sentence. He asked for 50 years, and Judge Fleck clearly agreed when she chose 46 years, 8 months. Bob's sentence also comes with a no contact order that only allowed him to contact his children through their guardian and the prosecutor's office.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So I found this article all about his sentencing hearing, and I'm going to read from, straight from this article. This will all be in the show notes. Durrell, Bob, was solemn through most of the sentencing until a friend of Carolyn's, I'm guessing it was Denise, because I saw a video clip in Forensic Files of the sentencing and the hearing, and it panned back to the people watching the trial. Mm-hmm. And I saw Denise like sitting between like Carolyn's parents, I think. A friend of Carolyn's showed a videotape with slides of her. There were pictures of Carolyn on horseback in the kitchen with her friends, family, and children. And when Durrell addressed the court, he emotionally told of knowing the pain of what it's like to have a family torn apart. He referred to the relationship he had with his wife as one of love and trust, and noted that Carolyn wrote in a Bible she dedicated to him that he, quote, was one of the nicest men she'd ever met.
No, he did she not.
He did not, however, take responsibility for her death, Fleck said, the judge, characterizing his demeanor, particularly during the trial, as, quote, sniveling.
Ew, gross.
Carolyn's mother, Lenore Roberts, told Bob that he was a monster who had disgraced not only his own family, but Roberts and her husband, Jim. You know, herself and Jim. The Robertses, Carolyn's parents, who are in their 60s, are raising the couple's children. And while they don't regret it, it wasn't what they expected to be doing in their retirement years. 2 years ago, Roberts, on behalf of the children, filed a wrongful death suit in King County Superior Court against Durrell to obtain funds from the estate to support the children. Tuesday, a judge ordered funds from the estate to be dispersed. But it's
good.
But it's little compensation. Quote, the light has gone out of my life, Roberts told the court. That was that article. Bob is still serving his sentence in the Monroe State Penitentiary. His sister visits him regularly. This is according to April. Hi, April. Thanks for the info. Apparently, she's pretty much the only family he has. Their mother passed away while he has been in prison, besides his children, who I suspect he doesn't see either, even though they are grown now. And then I found an online memorial site that had this to say about Carolyn. Carolyn was the daughter of Lenore, Lenny.
Oh,
and, I know. And Jim Roberts. She had one brother. Carolyn was a loving and devoted mother of two sons and a daughter. She was well liked by her coworkers at Morgan Stanley Dean Witter in Bellevue. She maintained and cared for a lovely home in the Renton Highlands, Summerwind subdivision. She loved to cook and bake and make little gifts for her friends. She was kind and thoughtful and liked people. She was a very hard worker, taking care of just about everything, including housework, yard work, and her family's needs. She also loved horses, and at the time of her death, she owned a horse named Drizzle.
Oh, Drizzle.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God.
And that is the story of what happened to Carolyn Roberts, a woman who I was... whose path I almost crossed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I could have worked with Carolyn, literally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, God. That's chilling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. God. Fucking douchey husbands.
Oh, seriously. And what
Fuck
is it?
That it's guy.
Like over and over again with the internet searches and the dumbass fucking made up story about two dudes that home invasioned their.
Give it a rest.
I seriously.
Just get a divorce. God, fuck.
It's that thing. We've talked about this so many times. Like, murder is never a solution to, like, a life problem. Like a regular life problem is not made better by putting murder into the mix.
No.
It's.
God damn it.
Anyway. Thank you, sister.
For that.
That's what I have for you today. Thanks, April.
Oh, thanks, April, I guess. God.
All right. You can interrogate her at virtual wine night, which we will be having soon for all our Chaos Kids Club members. So if you want to get in on that action, you got to go sign up to be a Chaos Kid Club member at our patreon.com/crime, wine, and chaos. It's $5 a month and you get a bonus episode every month.
Word. All right. I was like, sorry. No, I was like, she didn't forget anything. So I got nothing. What she said is true.
Do you have some chaos for us?
Did you see me like with the blank stare for a second? Like,
yes,
God, I do. And, you know, listen, we have had just bleak story after bleak story. So
it's true.
I mean, this one isn't not bleak, but I've gone with a paranormal vibe for you.
Ooh, today. I'm into a paranormal vibe. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got this story suggestion from Jade. Have you ever heard of the Sally House?
Only because you've mentioned it to me before, but no.
Okay. Oh, because I told you that it was recommended that you sage yourself before you dive into this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Listen.
I didn't sage myself. Should I sage myself right now?
No, I saged myself. I mean, it's either be proactive or try and get the demons out later. It's up to you.
I mean, somebody told me that you can over cleanse, you know.
Oh,
because okay. Then you might drive out some of the good ones that want to hang out and help you out.
Mm. Oh, my God. This has nothing to do with anything. But can I?
Great.
It might be upsetting, but how's your emotional bandwidth right now?
I'm good. What do you got, sis?
Jade had a psychic reading. Another one. This time she did a. Well, Michael did a deep dive finding like who was the most recommended or whatever. So she did a psychic reading.
Okay.
And this person that she did a reading with, both of our grandmothers came through. And what the woman said was they were Joe and Kitty. Uh-huh. Was that she couldn't differentiate, like they were both talking to her. She said one of them is upset about her burial.
Is it Kitty?
Well, yeah. Like she didn't appreciate how that went down.
She's upset about a lot more than just that.
Yeah, but isn't that wild?
Yeah, because Grandma Jo, she got what she wanted.
Exactly.
She got the perfect Catholic burial that she wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And we ate bologna and American cheese on white bread and everything afterwards.
Mm-hmm. And then she told Jade, somebody in your life named Mike needs to check on his brother.
Has anybody called Uncle Sam recently?
Or it could be Michael's brother, my Michael.
Maybe.
I know. I thought about texting Uncle Sam, but.
And you didn't?
No, I don't want to. Well, I might. I might. I, you know, anyway.
Highly encourage somebody check on Uncle Sam.
I will. I'll text him after this. Okay.
You know,
so anyway.
But okay. Great. Okay. Now I'm really in the mood for some spookiness. Get us going. Sally House.
Sally House. So we are, Sally House is located at 508 North 2nd Street in Atchison, Kansas.
Okay.
It's a small rural farming rural. Community.
This is a horror story in a rural place.
In a rural It's about 50 miles northwest of Kansas City.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's also called the Window to the West, and it happens to be the birthplace of Amelia Earhart.
No. Okay.
So those are fun facts. So the Sally House was built in the 1870s on a quiet suburban street just a few blocks from the Missouri River.
Here we are on the Missouri River again.
Nothing good happens on the Missouri River.
You guys stay away from the Missouri River.
And the Cascade Mountains. That's the first thing I
and the Mississippi. Thought we... Mm-hmm. There's just so many places. Just stay in your house, sit in your room.
That's what I do. Seriously. Fuck.
Sorry.
Keep I've going. Been in this exact room in this chair since 6 o'clock this morning. I worked from home today. I literally am in like an 8x8 box. Just
you're
existing.
Safe though. You're safe there.
It's my safe corner. Like when you stand in the doorway in old school Zelda and nothing can get you.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. So it's a, Missouri River. It's 1,200 square feet, 3-bedroom, 2-bath. In the late 1800s, the Finley family occupied the home, and Dr. Charles Finley had his practice there. The family lived on the second floor, and the first floor was used for office and exam rooms.
Uh-oh.
So the legend has it that in 1906, a little girl was extremely sick one night. Something was wrong with her tummy. This was the little girl, Sally. So Sally's mom rushed her to the neighborhood doctor, Dr. Charles Finley, and the doctor determined that the little girl needed an appendectomy and quickly before her appendix ruptured.
Oh, I do have vague little tiny bells ringing on this story.
Yeah. Well, this guy was a physician and not a surgeon.
Uh-huh.
And he moved very, very quickly, so much so that no pain meds had taken effect and there was no anesthesia. And he sliced Sally open.
Yep.
And just started digging around in there.
Yep.
He was unable to find her appendix and the little girl died on the table.
Yep.
So the Finley family remained in the house for several decades. And over the course of their residency, three other Finley members. Finley family members. Whoa.
Finley Sally family. Seashells. Say that three times.
Finley family. Fuck. Also died in the home.
Uh-huh.
So immediately after the Finleys were out of there, a single woman with three children moved in and she lived at 508 North 2nd Street for 40 years.
Whoa. Okay.
I know. She says that the only unusual things that she ever noticed was that one of her daughters did have an imaginary friend named Sally.
No.
Mm-hmm. And at one time there was a small fire that started without any logical explanation, but nobody got hurt.
That's all.
No bigs.
Mm-hmm. Just spontaneous combustion.
Oh, God. So after this family moved out, Tony and Debbie Pickens moved in. It was December of 1992. And this would be the first time since the Finleys that a man occupied the house.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Some ghost hunting experts believe that Sally had some serious issues with men because of what happened to her. And that is why the sudden ramped up activity in the house.
Okay.
All right.
I mean, it started
valid. Yeah. It started out pretty benign with like dimming lights and cold spots in the home, but it was an old house. So the young couple figured it just had heating and electrical problems, right?
Yep.
Shortly after moving in, the couple became pregnant with their first child. And as soon as one of the rooms was turned into a nursery, this entity seemed to turn their attention there.
Uh-oh.
Uh-huh. Electronics near the nursery would turn off. If someone was using the landline phone anywhere near the nursery, the call would drop. And Tony and Debbie would regularly hear scratching sounds at night coming from the nursery.
Ew.
I hate it. I have chills and I already know I wrote this. It's like, oh, that part was scary. Like I wrote it. Oh, God, that one got me. That one crept up on me.
You're so cute. I love you.
I love you. One night, they distinctly heard the sound of furniture being moved across the floor. But when they went into the room, nothing had been moved.
No.
No.
That's what I would say too. I'd walk into the room and just say it like that.
Me too. That's where an over cleanse would happen. I would over cleanse that room. Yes. Like, I don't, everything needs to go. I don't care.
No.
Yeah. At one time, their next door neighbor was chatting with them outside and had asked the Pickens why they leave the nursery light on all night, because it was like shining into her house.
What?
And they were like, yeah, no, we don't.
How is a baby sleeping while the light is on all night?
Baby's not there yet. This is just
This is pre-baby.
This is preparing for the baby. So after their son Taylor was born, Debbie and Tony came home one night after an evening out and found all of the stuffed animals in Taylor's room had been pulled down and were positioned into a circle on the floor.
In the nursery?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Babe, we got to move.
There's a stuffy seance. Like, what are we doing?
We got to move. Yeah. We got to go. We're not staying here.
Uh-huh. They would regularly wake up in the middle of the night to Taylor, like, screaming bloody murder. And every time they went into his room, the lights would be on.
Why would they? Okay, this is why you just co-sleep. Okay, just co-sleep. Bring your baby into the bed with you. Do not leave the baby alone in the room where the crazy weird activity is happening every night. Come on.
We won't go in there, but our baby will.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. What are they doing? What are you doing?
Yeah. Then they started to find mold on random things throughout the house that didn't make sense, like on Taylor's toys.
Gross.
Yeah. So they eventually moved the nursery to a different bedroom, but the activity became more frequent and more violent, and it just moved to the new nursery. There were several times when Tony would suddenly experience a burning pain on his back or stomach, and when Debbie would lift up his shirt, there would be fresh, bloody scratch marks either down his back or across his stomach.
Oh, no. Mm-hmm.
That's a hard pass for me. So
We're moving.
And they're renters, too.
Like, get the fuck out. Rent a different place. What are we doing?
I mean, they're young. They have a new baby. I'm sure money's tight. They've signed a lease. Always, you know,
it's always you're stuck because of the I mean, this is right. We need more affordable housing, people. We need more affordable housing. This is a really good reason right here. Sometimes you just got to move.
Sometimes it's urgent. Yeah. You need emergency affordable housing.
Yes. Yeah.
Need a 3-bedroom tonight. Can that happen?
Yes. Put the TV out.
So eventually the Pickens decide to try a different approach. They thought that maybe if they befriended Sally and made her feel welcome, that she would chill out.
Okay, this is kind of akin to like, don't feed the trolls. You know what I mean? You do not invite something like this to get closer to you.
Well, here's the thing. Like, lots of experts there's a debate about whether or not this violent thing in the house is Dr. Charles Finley or Sally.
Or something else entirely.
Or something else entirely, yeah. So they would even try to speak to her like out loud and include her in like family conversations and like, but you know, like, oh, like she's a little girl. She wants to be included, but it didn't help.
I hate it.
I hate it too. Oh God. So they started getting desperate. And at the time there was a very popular show on TV called Sightings. Do you remember Sightings?
Uh-huh. Vaguely remember it.
Yep. So they reach out to them and the crew, the film crew, set up in their house. They stayed on site for several days and they were able to capture flickering lights. And they also reported cold spots in the house. And they even were there to witness one of the attacks on Tony, where he ended up with bleeding scratch marks out of nowhere.
Okay.
Don't like it.
Nope.
The Pickens said that things got a little bit easier after the sighting crew had visited, but it didn't last long.
Right.
One night, the family was having a birthday dinner for Taylor when a stuffed animal suddenly went up in flames.
More spontaneous combustion.
Mm-hmm.
Got a little pyro on our hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At this time, they had lived in the home for 2 years and they were done. They were like, nope.
Gotta go. That was like at least 18 months longer than I would have handled it.
I know.
You know?
I know. They missed the sweet spot while she was still pregnant and that could have been more manageable.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. So after the Pickens packed up and moved out, the film crew came back to the house to try to get more footage. They stayed overnight, and in the middle of the night, they captured moaning in the nursery.
Ew.
Uh-huh. And when they went upstairs, the nursery lights were on, and it was icy cold.
Mm-hmm.
I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, several paranormal investigators have gone in. One investigative duo picked up an audio track of a voice that sounded female, and it said, "The blue and the gold will catch the light," followed by like a creepy little laugh.
What does that mean?
I don't know. Earn more sessions by sleeving.
Exactly.
Oh my God. On January 17th, 2015, it appeared on an episode of the Travel Channel series Ghost Adventures. It has been featured twice on the show BuzzFeed Unsolved Supernatural. The paranormal investigation discovered that Sally could possibly be a demon disguised as the spirit of the girl who died in the house. The two also experienced an attachment where the entity followed them after their time at the Sally house for a little while. So some people think it's like a poltergeist.
I mean, there's all just like making shit up about what things are or whatever.
Totally, totally. It was listed on the real estate website Zillow for $1 million in February of 2016, then dropped down to $499,000, and then in August taken off the market. The house has remained empty and is now a tourist attraction.
Who owns it?
I have no idea. I think it might be the same guy, Lee something, that was renting to the Pickens.
Really?
I'm not sure. Mm-hmm.
You know... I'm not a big fan of the term demon, just because whenever you start getting into that, it's all very religious, right? It's like demons yeah. are this like religious thing. But I've definitely heard about this other type of entity that some people have talked about. And I don't know a lot about them, but I've heard a few different people talk about this version of entity they call elementals.
I've heard that.
They're basically like, they're like, beings, they're like spirit beings, basically, for lack of a better word. And they've never been, nor are they in any way, shape or form human.
Mm.
You know, like I guess demon would be like ascribing kind of a religious brush to it, because that's mm-hmm. kind of like what demons are. Supposedly right. in a religious context. So it's like they're just giving it like their what their understanding of that would be. But I don't know. I can't remember. I feel like elementals is something that maybe comes from like an indigenous culture's mm-hmm. take on it kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole like scratching and stuff is like mm-mm. really, and like the negative aggression, like it's one thing if something's haunting you and it's being annoying. It's another mm-hmm. thing if it's being like, it's like attacking you.
Yeah. Where do you draw the line in terms of someone died in my house? Like old person, natural causes is okay.
I mean, usually old person, natural causes, if it's haunted because of that, they're usually like an imprint, like, mm-hmm. haunting, or what they call like a residual haunting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like their energy was just there for so long and they passed there that they kind of left this imprint of their energy there. They usually don't really like even interact. They just like are there, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Amber. I don't know.
In my tier list of where it's progressively getting worse, which my hard stop is old person died peacefully. Next would be died by suicide in the home, followed by a murder happened in the home.
Sure. Sure.
Are any of those a hard pass? I'm not living here for you.
Hard to say.
Yeah.
Hard to say. In this market, what's the, like, am I getting a good deal on the home? You know what I mean?
It's so sad. I do know what you mean. Okay. Then you can relate to the Pickens.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, remember when you told the story about Arpana and you were like legit, I went and looked up to see if there were anything vacant to see if Jade could afford to live there. I mean,
mm-hmm. I know. Yeah. Oh God.
That's like the whole premise of the movie Poltergeist, right? One of the reasons why they didn't leave the house is because they couldn't afford to live anywhere else. They eventually mm-hmm. did leave, like, because they had no other choice. I mean, they had to, but they were like, destitute after that.
I know. The Watcher House too. They were destitute after that. Yep,
exactly.
It's so sad. Ugh, wow.
Well, sister, thanks for that spooky yuki.
You're welcome. I hate it. I hate it too.
I don't want any part of that in my life.
No. Samesies.
But we did it. We made it through. Go to the order.
All the things. We're on the Book of Faces. We're on the Instagram. We're on Twitter. We're on TikTok. We have a website. We have a Patreon. You know, you can mingle with us in all sorts of ways.
And if you want to be like April and send us like a laundry list of things we should do stories about, please do. We are happy to get your suggestions, and you can send those to us. You can send love letters to Amber. You can send hate mail to me. They all go to the same inbox though, and that's crimewineandchaos@gmail.com.
That's right.
Sister, I love sister, you.
Love you.
So good to see your lovely face. And
you
that
too.
Was
samesies.
Fucking chaotic.
Fucking chaotic. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Crime, Wine, and Chaos is produced by 8th Direction Records. Artwork by Joshua M. Davis. Music by Paul Abner. If you would like to support the show, you can visit our Patreon page at crimewineandchaos.com/Patreon. Cheers!
Maybe it's still true. You don't know.
Should I sage myself right now?